Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the short-handed Supreme Court returning to work this week and President Obama's article in the Huffington Post, Republican Obstruction is Undermining the Supreme Court, in which Obama accuses the Republican Congress of trading partisanship for progress on a range of issues that would rebuild the nation's infrastructure, create jobs, combat the opioid epidemic, and deal with poverty. Eric Siegel, a professor of law at Georgia State University School of Law and author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges, joins us to discuss how Senate Majority Leader McConnell is defying the Constitution in as much as it does not say a president is only able to govern for the first 3 years of a four-year term. But while it has been 202 days since Obama nominated a replacement for the late Justice Scalia, Eric Siegel argues that an 8-member court's rulings on most issues would be preferable to a 9-member court that brought us Citizens United and gutted the Voting Rights Act. Then we'll speak with a former Secretary of Defense, William Perry, who is a professor emeritus at Stanford University, where he served as director of the Preventative Defense Project. The author of My Journey at the Nuclear Brink, he joins us to discuss his article in the New York Times, Why It Is Safe to Scrap America's ICBMs, and the launch of the William J. Perry Project, the first free online course on nuclear weapons, Living at the Nuclear Brink. We will also look into the dangers of accidental nuclear war and the wrong direction that Obama's trillion-dollar nuclear modernization program is taking us, in particular the destabilizing new nuclear-tipped cruise missile. Then finally, just before the vice presidential candidate's first and only debate is about to begin, Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University, joins us to discuss how, while Senator Tim Kaine might try to tie Indiana's Governor Mike Pence to Donald Trump, this may actually help the Republican ticket. She argues that because Pence can appear to be more reasonable, he will assuage voters who might be unsettled by Trump's antics by showing that a Vice President Pence, who will be actually running the country while Donald Trump makes speeches and promotes his brand, will be a steady hand on the reins of power. And joining us now is Eric Siegel, who is a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. He's the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Siegel.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be back with you.
And Eric, the president has come out with an essay which is published in the Huffington Post, Republican obstruction is undermining the Supreme Court. Enough is enough. And of course, the Supreme Court is back at work, and it's been a long time that they've only had eight justices following the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And the president, of course, nominated Merrick Garland 202 days ago, and he has not even had his day in court.
Day in court, yeah.
Exactly. So this fit of pique from the president follows a recent speech by Harry Reid on the floor of the Senate, where he blasted Mitch McConnell and the Republicans for their obstruction and basically said that they've created this Frankenstein monster in Donald Trump and they're welcome to him. But it was a very, very powerful and biting speech. And to a lesser extent, the president's essay today is pretty biting. But do you accept the premise that Harry Reid put forth, that this treatment of this president, who on his first day, in the first day that he was inaugurated, the Republican leadership met and plotted to make him a one-term president, as Mitch McConnell openly stated, is there an element of racism in the extent to which this president has not been treated as any of his predecessors have?
No, I don't think. I'm not going to suggest that Congress has treated the president badly because of racism. I will suggest, and I agree with you, that I think the implications of what you're saying, that the Congress has treated the president in an unprecedentedly terrible manner, disrespectful manner. I don't think the Merrick Garland issue is the best example of that. I think there are many other examples. But I don't think this is a racist issue. I think this is a political partisan issue. So that's my answer to that. As far as the president's article in the Huffington Post today, and as far as Harry Reid's diatribes about Merrick Garland, I agree that what the Senate is doing is unprecedented. But unlike all of my fellow liberals and most of my fellow conservative academic law professors, I think that there are some very significant silver linings to what the Senate is doing, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. And it's teaching us something extremely important about the Supreme Court that we should really pay attention to. So although I agree what they're doing has really never been done before, and I think it's a continuation of the anti-Obama, you know, direction of the Congress, not based on racism, but based on politics, I disagree that the court needs to have nine justices, and I've been writing that and talking a lot about that. I'm definitely in a minority, but I think I can make my case.
And I'd like you to make the case, but just before we do so, it does seem, though, that there's nothing in the Constitution that says a president has basically no power in his last year. And that's the implication here, isn't it? That
Well, yes. The Constitution is absolutely... The Constitution treats a 7-year and 11-month president exactly as it treats a 1-year, 1-month president. But there is nothing in the United States Constitution, not a syllable, that suggests that the Senate has to act on presidential Supreme Court nominations. Now, we can get to a point where if the court only had 3 or 4 justices and the Senate was obstructing it, then there might be a separation of powers issue, but it wouldn't be vis-a-vis the president. It would be vis-a-vis the court. There certainly the structure of our Constitution suggests, and the text, there has to be a Supreme Court, and we can debate what that means exactly. But it doesn't go to the president's power, because the Senate is under no obligation to hold hearings, which they never did until the 20th century anyway, or approve any nominee the president sends forward. So I think on both issues, the Constitution, I think you're right about the presidency, but I think, you know, McConnell is right about the Constitution and Supreme Court nominations.
And the number of justices is not stated in the Constitution.
Correct. Congress passed a law in 1869 saying 9. Congress could change that tomorrow. If the president vetoed it, they'd have to override it. But that's in a federal law. That can be changed.
So why then do you think that the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts is going along with this? Is he exhibiting partisanship by going along with this? Because he has expressed irritation at the lack of judges on the federal bench. He stood up for his branch of government, which is the judicial branch. Is he not standing up for his branch of government in allowing this situation to linger with
Well, I
vacancy?
Think one of the great mysteries of modern day Supreme Court commentary is why Justice Roberts does the things he does. So I'm not going to guess at Justice Roberts' motivation. As someone who has constantly defended Scalia's and Ginsburg's right to speak out in public about issues, I think the court should speak out much more often. I am nevertheless sympathetic to Justice Roberts' very difficult position, which is in an election year, and with the 8-person court being an issue, I think he actually is probably taking the right track in being quiet about it. I'm not a fan or defender of Justice Roberts. But to the extent he's been silent on this, I think that is likely the best posture. I get that. And I'm one who I defended Ginsburg's Trump comments. I defended Scalia's comments throughout his career off the court, not on the court, but off the court. So I think I have some credibility to say I think Roberts is doing the right thing right now by being quiet about this.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Siegel, who's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law and the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. So let's talk about why you don't think the fact that there are 8 justices on the court and that there has been no replacement for Justice Antonin Scalia, and it's been 202 days since the president nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court.
So there are a lot of reasons why a 4-4 evenly divided court among Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives is a really good idea and, in fact, should be made permanent by the Senate, which it has the power to do. Now, when I explain my reasons, I'll do it quickly, but when I explain it, I'm not suggesting my theory is the perfect theory or the perfect system. I'm just suggesting it's better than the system we have now. From 1900 to 1936, an ideologically conservative, reactionary court struck down over 200 laws dealing with unions and workers' rights and child labor in the mines. They struck them down. There's nothing America could do about it. and they were wrong in doing so, and that went on for 35 years for no other reason than there were five votes to do it. From the other perspective, during the Warren Court, there are many people, and I don't share this view necessarily, but there are many people who think the Warren Court went too far. Why did the Warren Court go too far to the left? Because they could. So one of the advantages of a 4-4 evenly divided court is in any major constitutional question that usually falls along partisan ideological lines, at least one Republican will have to vote with the four Democrats or one Democrat will have to vote with the four Republicans. That is a wonderful institutional check on the ability of unelected life-tenure justices to engage in the kind of behavior that the court often has engaged in throughout American history. Because of life tenure, the justices on the court often fall out of touch with American culture and American society. And this is a check on that. So that's one reason. A second reason is, as we saw last term, if you need to get one switch, one Republican to go, you know, Democrat or the other way around, the court will in fact decide cases more narrowly. They will decide cases more carefully, and they will frankly decide fewer big cases. To me, that is a very good thing, because if the court doesn't decide the case, it's divided 4-4. Either refuses to take it or takes it and then goes 4-4, that doesn't mean the issue gets undecided. It means the Court of Appeals, there's 12 of them, have the final say. And you know what? The judges on the United States Court of Appeals from California to New York, from Oregon to Florida, are more educationally diverse, politically diverse, geographically diverse than 8 or 9 lawyers sitting in Washington, D.C. And I'll finish with this. My point about that is, the fundamental question in every constitutional law case ever decided is, when should 5 lawyers in Washington make the decision for the rest of us? And whether you're liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, the answer should be very rarely. And if the only reason they're doing it is because we have 5 Democrats or 5 Republicans, that's not a good enough reason. And maybe in that situation, California, Texas, New York, and Oregon might have to have different rules. And I would add to that that 99.5% of federal cases never get to the Supreme Court. So to the extent people are complaining we need a final, you know, final decision maker, the answer is 99.5% of cases never get there anyway. So the need for uniformity is a fake issue. And I think the need to avoid the Lochner Court's 220-year practice of striking down 200 laws, or maybe the Warren Court's going too far to the left, is a more compelling need than worrying about the one in 1,000 cases that require uniformity. Sorry, I'm done. End of diatribe.
Well, but Eric Segal, surely, though, if you have this tie, which means that if there's a tied vote 4-4, then it goes back to the lower court, the appeals court decision, which is not uniform across the country. So therefore, if you the recent decision on gay marriage, clearly, if it came from the southern courts, it would have a different, Texas, for example, it would have a different outcome than if it came from the California court. And then you could go back through all of the civil rights legislations, et cetera. So I thought that one of the reasons why the Supreme Court was important and had the final word was that it settled things nationally. Because if you allow things to be settled regionally, then, you know, the conservative part of the country basically has its own...
Well, hold on. There's two, I think, pretty good responses to that. One is, you mentioned the gay rights case, and you and I agree about the gay rights case, but with 8 justices, there wouldn't be Shelby County, the horrific voting rights case. There wouldn't be Citizens United, the horrific First Amendment case. So, I mean, we can get into that shouting match, Ian, but I've studied American history from 1787 to the present, and I'm here to tell you the court is much more anti-progressive, much more conservative over time than it's liberal and progressive. The court is almost never progressive. And even in the gay rights cases, that would have happened anyway. It would have taken longer, and that would have been a shame, but it would have happened anyway. That's one reaction. A second reaction is, when you say we need a national rule, the truth is, in 99.5% of federal issues that are in the federal courts, we don't have a national rule. In fact, the law of abortion, affirmative action, to some degree free speech, definitely criminal procedure, and all kinds of other issues, as we, you know, has been different in different parts of the country for the last 50 years. So the real question is, when is there a uniformity need for one rule? And the answer to that, surprisingly, is actually only in economic cases. There might be some antitrust cases or other cases where big national corporations need a rule, you know, but in that situation, the court is almost never 5-4. I mean, almost never. So those cases are going to be decided anyway. So what you're really worried about is the universe of cases where the court will be 5-4, which is less than 20% of the cases, in a case that requires uniformity, which is very rare. And then at Shelby County, you'd be happier without Shelby County, right? You'd be happier without Citizens United, arguably, if you're a liberal. So we're talking about a very small universe of cases. I agree there are some cases where we might need that and might not get it, but compared to the Supreme Court striking down 200 progressive laws dealing with unions, workers, and child labor for 30 years because they were out of touch, I'll take the risk of losing the uniform rules if you give me back those 200 laws.
Well, for example, Eric Segal, abortion, we're the only advanced democracy that has an obsession over abortion. it's clear that there is an obsessive political need to continually challenge Roe v. Wade. What would happen to that? I mean,
what would happen is what was happening until last year, which is different parts of the country would have. I mean, Roe versus Wade was the national rule, so states couldn't prohibit abortion altogether. What they could do is make it harder. And I'm pro-choice all the way down. I met my wife through Planned Parenthood. I am pro-choice all the way down. I am on record as saying Roe versus Wade was incorrectly decided. But the real answer to your question is, until this last opinion, which took 8 years to get to, the rules in Texas on abortion were different than the rules in California, which were different than the rules in New York, which is exactly what happened prior to Roe versus Wade. And I would suggest to you that without Roe versus Wade, poor women in this country today would have a much easier chance of getting abortion than with Roe versus Wade. But that's a hard backlash argument that goes beyond our conversation. And with both Brown versus Board of Education and Roe versus Wade, it is extremely unclear whether the Supreme Court did more harm than good. And I can make that argument, but I don't think you want me to make it now. I've made it in print many, many times. Justice Ginsburg, by the way, I think believes, and no one's more feminist than Justice Ginsburg, I think she believes Roe versus Wade was a mistake. She has said many times that the court should not have done that in one fell swoop. I agree with that. And that's the reason she waited on the gay rights issue. So remember, the DOMA was before the Supreme Court, as was a California law, a constitutional amendment on same-sex marriage. They decided the DOMA case. Five judges said no jurisdiction over the California case. And Justice Ginsburg was one of those five judges who said, she joined the conservatives, who said no jurisdiction. The reason she did that was she wanted to wait two more years before deciding state laws on same-sex marriage. I think she was right to do that. I think Roe versus Wade was a dreadful mistake the way it was decided for people on the left and for pro-choice activists, and I think she agrees with that. So I'll rest with Justice Ginsburg on that issue.
Well, let's turn to the way that I think the court, in the way that it's reported and covered by the press, gets it wrong in the sense that they talk about liberal versus conservative justices. I don't believe that there are any liberal justices really on that court compared to the Warren Court that you mentioned earlier, with people like William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, etc. The court has gone really inexorably to the right over the decades. And you mentioned earlier courts, of course, that were absolutely reactionary, leading FDR to think about stacking the court because he couldn't get his New Deal legislation through. So what explains that? Is it just that the country itself has sort of suppressed the left, for the want of a better description? And until Bernie Sanders showed up, I don't think anybody in the punditry recognized that there was in this country a lot of people who, once they heard a message from somebody like a Bernie Sanders on the left, that it resonated, because
a great question, and there is no sound. I don't have a soundbite answer to that question because it is a very smart and tough question to answer. I have a couple of reactions. One is, when you said there are no real liberals on the Supreme Court now compared to where the Warren Court was. Judge Posner and I have discussed this issue, and he wouldn't mind me saying that I think the political science answer to you is America has moved so much more to the center that the Supreme Court always reflects kind of the dominant American center. So I do think Sotomayor, and Kagan and Ginsburg, I'm not sure about Breyer, are to the left of center as much as Brennan and Douglas, you know, were back in the 1960s when America was much more to the left. So I think that's one answer to your question. But a more fundamental answer to your question, and one that I, as a self-identifying progressive on the left, I keep trying to tell the people, and they don't listen to me, but I think I'm right about this, and there are a few other scholars who agree, is that the Supreme Court is by definition a reactionary institution. What is the court's job in constitutional law? It is to enforce the Constitution. What is the Constitution? An old document with old-fashioned values reflecting a time long ago. So if you want progressive change to happen in America, you don't go to the Constitution. That's not the place to go. And I don't think it is the job of lawyers and judges sitting in Washington to move our country to the left. And even when they think it is their job, as the Warren Court did for 10 years, it's a backlash every time because people in Missouri and Oregon aren't going to listen to the Supreme Court very well. I mean, they respect the institution, but you know they see the judges for what they are, Harvard and Yale elite lawyers sitting in the nation's capital. So the reason I've spent my career arguing the court should do less, not more, is based on two rationales. One is a non-ideological, I think it's better for our country, period, when the Supreme Court does less. But if I put my partisan hat on, as a liberal progressive, we would, you and me, because I know you're also a liberal progressive, would be better off with a very, very weak Supreme Court, because it more often than not stops change rather than causes change. That's my answer.
Well, I thank you for your answer, and I thank you for joining us, Eric Siegel.
Thank you, and I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Siegel, who's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law and the author of Supreme Myths, Why the Supreme Court is Not a Court and Its Justices Are Not Judges. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the former Secretary of Defense, William Perry.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is William Perry, who's Professor Emeritus at Stanford University, a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute and the Hoover Institution, and serves as Director of the Preventative Defense Project. An expert on U.S. foreign policy, national security, and arms control, he was the 19th Secretary of Defense for the United States and currently serves on the Defense Policy Board and is a member of the National Academy of Engineering and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. William Perry recently had an op-ed in the New York Times, Why It Is Safe to Scrap America's ICBMs, and he's the author of a memoir, My Journey at the Nuclear Brink. And today, the William J. Perry Project is launching the first free online course on nuclear weapons, Living at the Nuclear Brink. It is free and open to the public and is offered in conjunction with Stanford University. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Perry.
Thank you, Ian.
And our audience benefit, what's the email address or the internet address to sign up for your free course on living in the nuclear brink?
Go to wjperryproject.org, wjperryproject.org. And there'll be a lot of information on that. But in particular, there's an opportunity for you to sign up for the course. The course, by the way, starts today. So this is very, but you can sign up and start later. It's an online course. You don't have to start the exact day.
So let's turn to your recent op-ed in the New York Times, Why It Is Safe to Scrap America's ICBMs. Of course, since it came out, Secretary of State Kerry has broken off talks with Russia over Syria in frustration. And then just yesterday, Vladimir Putin suspended the treaty the U.S. has with Russia to dispose of weapons-grade plutonium. definitely signs of a worsening in the relationship and rolling back post-Cold War progress. So I guess your op-ed, it's a hard sell, is it not, or getting harder?
Well, as long as we have a deteriorating relation with Russia, we have to be concerned about maintaining our deterrence. My first point in the article is that our deterrence is maintained adequately by our submarine forces and by our strategic bombers. In fact, to maintain just by our submarine forces, the strategic bomber forces serve as a backup and insurance policy on that. So I think we have adequate deterrence with those two elements of the force, and therefore, in the modernization of our forces, I favor going only to modernize the submarine forces and building a new strategic bomber and letting our ICBM forces phase out.
So this could be done unilaterally, in other words?
It can be done unilaterally. Right. It would be good if the Russians followed suit, but we cannot count on that and really don't expect it. So I think the question is, what is good for our own national security? And I believe for our own national security, deterrence is provided quite adequately by the submarine forces and by the strategic bomber, and that not only do we save money by not building the ICBM force, but we avoid a very real danger, namely the danger of accidentally starting a nuclear war by a false alarm. And that's something which only the ICBM force is susceptible to.
And that's because the ICBM force is essentially a first strike, use them or lose them weapon, a counterforce weapon.
The ICBMs are located, based in silos whose location is known, and therefore we would assume that if the Russians were to launch a first strike against it, they would be part of its targets. And so if our alert system indicates that missiles are on the way to the United States, the president then has to decide whether to launch our ICBMs before they land. In other words, he has to decide to launch them before he has any positive confirmation. He has only the indications from our warning system. That warning system has malfunctioned several times in the past, at least three times that I'm aware of. One time I myself was woken in the middle of the night by the North American Air Defense Command telling me that their computers were showing 200 ICBMs on the way from the then Soviet Union to the United States. So to me, it is not an academic question. I have a very, very vivid recollection of that incident, at which time I thought for one horrible moment that we were about to see the end of the world by the beginning of a nuclear catastrophe.
So arguably, in this post-Cold War environment, William Perry, we have the worst of both worlds. We have sort of psychological disarmament in the sense that nobody expects a nuclear war between Russia and the United States anymore. But on the other hand, we don't have physical disarmament, and the systems are still there. We have the football following the president around. The Russians have the Cheget following the Putin around. And it would seem that with this trillion-dollar nuclear modernization program underway that President Obama is calling for, surely that is going in the wrong direction. Shouldn't we be in an environment where we're de-emphasizing nuclear weapons rather than deal with this appalling situation that you just alluded to, where the president has such a narrow window of time to make this fateful decision upon which the fate of the Earth depends?
I believe that is exactly right. Let me be very clear, though. I do not believe an accidental launch is likely. I don't think it's a high probability at all. I don't want to be an alarmist about this. Maybe it's only 1% or 2%, but in my judgment, it's not worth taking any risk. We should not take that risk at this time. We took it all during the Cold War. We had some very close calls because of that during the Cold War. I don't think it's necessary to take that risk again, because I believe we can have quite adequate deterrence forces with our submarines and our bombers.
So why then are we heading in this direction then of nuclear modernization, and particularly the nuclear-tipped cruise missile that concerns you? And Hillary Clinton at a private fundraiser answered a question in regard to that Pentagon pet project, which she said is the last thing we need. That, of course, was leaked possibly by the Russians, by a conservative website, presumably to make Hillary Clinton look like a hawk. But the fact that she sort of did the opposite, I think, sort of almost backfired in the sense that her main problem, I think, is with the left of the Democratic Party who do perceive her as a hawk. So yeah. What did you make of it?
Well, the main problem, I think, as we plan our modernization, is not how you achieve deterrence, because, as I said, I believe that can be achieved quite adequately with the submarine forces and the bombers. There is a natural tendency left over from the Cold War to try to do the same thing the Russians do, not to let them have something that we don't have. And so we know they have ICBM forces. We know they're going to continue to have ICBM forces. And therefore, we're very reluctant to give them up. It's almost to keep up with the Joneses. We not only want to keep up with them in terms of numbers, but we also want to have the same kinds of capabilities that they have. So that is really the issue, I think. And I call it a Cold War mentality. It's a thinking about the Russians left over from the way we used to think about the Soviet Union during the Cold War.
But if we were to launch cruise missiles, and many have been launched since the end of the Cold War in Afghanistan and Iraq, for example, there's no way for the enemy to know whether this missile, incoming cruise missile, is a nuclear tip or not. That seems to me the most destabilizing nature of this weapon, that it sort of, in a way, joins the fixed ICBMs in the sense that it suddenly becomes a first-strike weapon.
Yes, I wrote an op-ed about that a few months ago, which brought out the point that the cruise missile was, air-launched cruise missile, is not only not necessary today, but it does have the destabilization quality. Again, it's not likely to start an accidental war, but why take that chance?
Well, that's, I think, the bottom line here is that it's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, let alone have one on by accident. And there was, of course, the Abel Archer incident back in November 1983, about which we still don't know the full details, but apparently the Russians thought that a NATO exercise was a springboard for a real attack, and apparently it had quite a profound effect on President Reagan. So
yes, we have had... during the Cold War, we have had at least three false alarms, which almost caused us, in at least one instance, almost caused us to launch an accidental war. We're not sure of how many the Soviet Union or the Russians have had, but we do know of at least two and maybe three that they have had. So this is not an academic issue. These machines do err. People do err. And when they err, and when the result of an error is the accidental nuclear war that brings civilization to an end, then you have to pay attention to that problem, and you have to find a way to minimize the chance that there could be any errors that could lead to the end of the world.
And given this new emphasis, William Perry, on cyber warfare, cyber espionage, and the fact that the Russians have been hacking into the DNC, the Clinton campaign, the Clinton Foundation, etc., and this leak that I referred to, the New York Times also wrote about on the same day that your op-ed was in the New York Times about statements at a private fundraiser that were leaked. Is there a connection then between cyber war and accidental nuclear war, given the computerized nature of it?
We don't really know, but we have to be concerned about that. If you imagined that a very clever and capable hacker could get into our command and control system, then there's always the possibility that he might be able to trigger our system to launch. I don't believe that is a real danger today, but it could become a danger in the years to come. And so, therefore, we have to be very concerned about cyber as a new threat, a threat that did not exist during the Cold War. And the threat is that it could somehow mislead our systems, and cause us to make a really grave error that could lead to a nuclear war.
Well, I think one of the almost accidental nuclear wars was a result of a training tape that was accidentally inserted, if my memory serves me correctly.
That was the false alarm which woke me up in the middle of the night.
Uh-huh.
This was back in, I think it was 1978. At the time, I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering. the general at the North American Air Defense had already concluded that this was something wrong with his equipment, that it wasn't real, even though it looked very realistic. And he was calling me to see if I could help him determine what had gone wrong with his computer. We couldn't figure that out over the telephone. It took us 2 or 3 days to actually determine that, in fact, what had happened was that an operator mistakenly put a training tape in the computer. Of course, the training tape was designed to look realistic, to look like a real launch. So it was probably the worst of all kind of accidents to happen. Fortunately, we had the general of the North American Air Defense Command was a very cautious and very wise individual, and he did not react to that. That call never got to the president, for example. It got to me, and it got to the National Security Advisor. In each case, trying to figure out what had gone wrong, not asking for a launch. But it was a very close call. If that had happened, for example, during a crisis time, if that had happened, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think it undoubtedly would have gone to the president, and we might very well have blundered into an accidental nuclear war.
So, William Perry, given the fact that the U.S. and Russian relationship is souring, and I don't think in geopolitics we've ever had this dangerous collusion, if you will, of nuclear weapons and organized crime, given that Russia in many ways is a kleptocratic sort of gangster state. In effect, you've got the mafia and the nuclear weapons, and that in itself is an extraordinary phenomenon. But just if we assume that there's still deterrence, which presumably there is because the consequences of nuclear war are so extraordinary. So if we have deterrence with both Russia and China, then you've got these wild cards like North Korea. And I think when you were Secretary of Defense, things got pretty tense with North Korea. Is it possible that in many ways North Korea is a kind of wild card that we always rely on the Chinese to do something about North Korea's continuing nuclear tests and missile tests, but they never really deliver? And the suspicion is now rising that some people think that maybe the Chinese like to have that sort of extra edge on deterrence, where you've got a kind of wild card out there that basically threatens the U.S. military in that region. And to some extent, you know, hardliners in China may think that serves their interests, just as Mao gave nuclear weapons to the Pakistanis as a way to neutralize the Indians.
Well, I think North Korea, which now has a small nuclear arsenal, is an added danger because of that. I want to be clear, though, I do not think their leadership is irrational. I do not think they would take an action which would lead to their own destruction. So I don't expect them to use that nuclear arsenal to launch an attack against the United States or against Japan or South Korea, because they realize that that would lead to the end of their regime, the end of their country. The one thing that they have always been sensible about and careful about is preserving their regime, preserving the leadership. That's their number one goal. So I do not believe they're going to take an action which is going to bring the regime in their country to an end. Nevertheless, having the nuclear arsenal does make them more dangerous, because that means they're going to undertake even more dangerous provocations, which could accidentally cause them to blunder into some sort of a military conflict, which could escalate into nuclear. So it's a dangerous situation, but it's not dangerous in the sense that they're going to conduct an unprovoked nuclear attack on the United States or our allies. I don't want to overestimate the danger.
Sure. Well, just in closing, in many ways, I think people listening to this conversation may think that we've been lucky, and I think we have, when you consider that there has not been a nuclear weapon used in anger since Nagasaki.
Yes.
But do you think, though, or do you agree with the consensus that the most likely place where a nuclear weapon would be used again would be in South Asia, perhaps with the Pakistanis having one of the fastest growing nuclear arsenals on the planet, I believe, and tensions there, of course, now heating up over Kashmir. So just give us a sense of, as alarming as things are between the U.S. and Russia, their relationship souring, how do you see the broader landscape?
I think the greatest danger to the United States of a nuclear catastrophe is a terrorist getting hold of a nuclear bomb. I put that number one on my list of concerns. This might only be one or two bombs, but even one or two bombs can cause a huge catastrophe. Secondly, I'm danger in my order of priority is a regional nuclear war, and the most likely candidate for that today is between India and Pakistan. That not only could cause millions of deaths in India and Pakistan, but conceivably could lead to a so-called nuclear winter, where all the smoke and particles from the burning cities gets into the atmosphere and causes a change in climate as a consequence for several years, causing crops to fail. So that's the second most dangerous situation. The third most dangerous situation is an accidental nuclear war. All of those are dangers we face today. None of them have a high probability, but any one of them could result in a huge catastrophe. So we should be paying special attention on what we can do to reduce the likelihood of any of those accidents happening. And my concern is that our policies today, our actions today, do not recognize those dangers and are not doing what we could do to reduce their likelihood.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, William Perry.
It's good to talk to you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with William Perry, who is Professor Emeritus at Stanford University, a Senior Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute, and he serves as Director of the Preventative Defense Project, an expert on U.S. foreign policy, national security, and arms control. He was the 19th Secretary of Defense of the United States and currently serves on the Defense Policy Board and is a member of the National Academy of Engineering and a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. William Perry recently had an op-ed at the New York Times, Why It Is Safe to Scrap America's ICBMs, and he is the author of a memoir, My Journey at the Nuclear Brink. And today, the William J. Perry Project is launching the first free online course on nuclear weapons, Living at the Nuclear Brink. It is free and open to the public. It's offered in conjunction with Stanford University. Just again, if you wouldn't mind telling us how to get this new William J. Perry Project of first...
Go to WJ Perry Project, wjperryproject.org. That will give you our website. And on the website, there are many things that are interesting you'd like to check out, but one of them gives you the opportunity to enroll in this course. The course is free, and it's not graded. You don't have exams. You have exams you can take if you want to take credit, but you don't have to do that. You can take the course just for your own education and information. I urge you to do that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, William Perry.
Thank you, Ian. Good to talk to you.
We're going to take a brief station break, and just before the vice presidential candidate's first and only debate, we'll be talking with a professor of political science at Indiana University. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she's the author of Party Politics in America, the major political party text now in its 17th edition, for which she received the American Political Science Association's Epstein Book Award for the best book on political parties. Welcome to Background Briefing, Professor Marjorie Hershey.
Thank you.
And tonight's debate between the vice presidential candidates, Tim Kaine and Mike Pence, will be beginning in about 15 minutes or so. And some people are suggesting that it may be a bit like what a lot of people felt back in 2000 when the vice presidential debate between Cheney and Lieberman took place. And a lot of people said, why can't these two candidates be at the top of their respective tickets? So I guess you could safely say that given the unpopularity of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, that might be the case tonight, or at the very least, that Kaine and Pence do represent in many ways, the traditional political positions of their respective parties.
Well, I think that's certainly true. I should point out that although it's commonly expected that people hate both of the national presidential candidates, in fact, most of the surveys show us that most people hate one of the national party's candidates, and that's the candidate of the party other than their own. It really isn't. I'm sure many people wish that they had candidates they liked better, but it really isn't the case that the antagonism is strong toward both candidates. It's a polarization question in which you tolerate your own party's candidate and you despise the other party's candidate. I think the two vice presidential candidates have very different styles, though not entirely the same as with the two in 2000. Mr. Pence is a former radio talk show host. He has a kind of preacher's style and a very strong speaking style. Kaine is a bit different. He's more of a friend than a preacher. He's not going to be very dramatic in his speaking style, but he may be more accessible in his speaking style.
Well, it does seem, though, that the real challenge that Governor Pence of Indiana has is he's bound to be tied to the top of the ticket, Donald Trump. And it's pretty hard to see how on many of Trump's core issues that already we know that much of what Pence has stood for is quite different in the sense that when he was governor, he expanded Medicaid. He's not out to kill Obamacare in the way that Trump is. And he was sort of ambivalent on the legal fate of 11 million undocumented immigrants. He certainly didn't want to deport them. So how much do you think Kaine can tie Pence to Trump?
Well, I think that it's a real advantage for the Trump ticket for Pence to be able to take more modified stands than the top of the ticket does, because Trump can say a variety of fairly outrageous things. Pence can contradict him in a more gentle way, and the audience is left thinking, well, you know, I could associate either point of view with this campaign, and those who are inclined to favor Republicans will probably think of Pence's stance. And those who are not will probably think of Trump's stance. I think that this is a really major opportunity for Governor Pence, because he has not had a very positive career as governor of Indiana. The chances of his reelection were really very much in doubt in the last year. His sponsoring of religious freedom restoration laws, his attempt to bar Syrian refugees from the state of Indiana, which was just recently stated to be unconstitutional. When Pence was chosen for the vice presidential ticket, this was basically his second shot at the brass ring. His ambition to become involved in national politics, which at least according to observers in the Indiana State House was very intense at the beginning of his governorship, seemed to have taken a real decline during the RFRA times and the other kinds of unfortunate pieces of legislation that he got involved with. But now he has another alternative, and by being a more moderate, if you can call it moderate, a more acceptable version of the Trump ticket, he might be the person who is the obvious next choice for the Republicans for the presidential nomination next time, or should something odd happen and Mr. Trump removes himself this time.
And again, I'm speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she's the author of Party Politics in America, The Major Political Parties, text now in its 17th edition, for which she received the American Political Science Association's Epstein Book Award for the best book on political parties. So much of then what we're being told about this, what to expect in this upcoming debate, which is that somehow Kaine is going to, because Trump is flaying about so much that somehow they can tie Pence to this erratic candidate who sends out these bizarre tweets at 3 a.m, etc., and seems to, although he's got an enormous amount of free media of late, people are starting to question his judgment, shall we say, and temperament. And certainly he didn't do well in the debate against Hillary Clinton. And I think the more you saw him, the more uncomfortable you were about the idea that how in God's name did this guy get to where he is, you know. So what you're telling us now is that actually Pence may end up helping Trump enormously by sweetening the bitter pill of swallowing Trump.
I think he may. I think he was certainly the preferred choice among the various candidates for vice president that Mr. Trump had in mind. Although, to be perfectly frank, I think anybody who is just now developing questions in their mind about Mr. Trump's judgment really is a bit slow on the uptake. It's been about a year and a half now that we've had the exposure to these things. But I think that in many Republicans' eyes that Mr. Pence adds to the ticket because he provides it with greater substance. But we have to remember the reports about when Mr. Trump talked with Governor Kasich and suggested that if Kasich ended his campaign for the primary elections, that Mr. Trump would put him on the vice presidential nomination on the ticket, and that then Mr. Kasich would have charge of domestic and foreign policy, which led him to question, well, what exactly is it then that Mr. Trump plans to do as president? So essentially, I think a lot of Americans are assuming that Mr. Pence would serve as president if Mr. Trump were elected. And that means that taking a closer look at Governor Pence's record in Indiana will be really important and really helpful to have a sense of how that kind of choice would work out.
Well, what I find interesting about the two men, not so much their politics, but their religiosity. In Tim Kaine, you seem to have somebody that's very sincere about his religion, and he went and did missionary service as a Catholic lay missionary in Honduras, speaks Spanish, etc. And there's no question that Pence does, to some extent, wear his religiosity on his sleeve, but he comes out of a sort of somewhat different religious tradition that's a little more fire and brimstone and more about hating gays and loving guns, etc. And do you think in any way that will be brought up, that their religiosity in terms of the contrast there?
I think that Governor Pence will do everything he can to bring it up. It's interesting that Governor Pence was actually raised as a Catholic, just as Tim Kaine was, but became an evangelical Protestant. When he introduces himself in Indiana and elsewhere, he almost invariably says, "I am a Christian first, and then a Republican second, or a public official second." So this is not something that anybody is going to need to bring up for him. He's going to have it front and center because it's been central to his view of politics and to his appeal in Indiana.
Well, indeed, before the conventions, I recall seeing when his limousine arrived with his family, him and his staff got into a kind of prayer circle before they entered the Republican convention. So if he were to become president, and as you point out quite correctly, Marjorie Hershey, that Donald Trump Jr. offered the the governor of Ohio, John Kasich, everything, both the domestic portfolio and the foreign policy portfolio, at which point the emissary for Governor Kasich said, "Well, what is Donald Trump going to do?" And the answer was, "He's going to make America great again." So it's the whole thing is pretty extraordinary. I must say, I just find that we're in a very strange world here, and perhaps these two tonight will take us out of that strange world for a time, given that they're more conventional politicians.
I think a lot of people would say amen to that if I can follow Governor Pence. I think that the issue of their religiosity, which I think is certainly more pronounced in the case of Governor Pence than it is in the case of Mr. Kaine, bears on a number of issues. It bears on, for example, a whole series of issues of personal responsibility and traditional values such as gay rights, abortion, women's rights. Mr. Pence believes it also bears on issues of the minimum wage and various other economic issues. So I think it's an important thing for people, to the extent to which vice presidents matter, to take a good look at where these two vice presidential candidates stand on substantive issues, because at least in the case of Mr. Trump's election, if that happens, we need to know a lot about what Governor Pence is likely to do.
Well, I recall the biblical phrase, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, particularly a rich man who doesn't pay his taxes. And I'm sure that people will try and tie Pence to Trump on the current matter over the taxes. But
it may be that it's a little easier for a rich man to get into the Oval Office than it is to get into heaven.
Right. But just in closing, though, it does seem that this may well be an avenue where you can get a different sense of the religiosity of these two men, where you have one who actually went and ministered to the poor in Honduras in the way that the prophet Jesus spent time ministering to the poor and dispossessed, and he didn't hang out with televangelists, and you know, certainly want to cut the minimum wage salaries of the poorest among us, you know, the least among us, as they say in the Bible. So do you think there's something to be said for Cain challenging Pence's religiosity?
Oh, I think definitely. I think that it really is about time in this presidential year for us to be talking about what these candidates, all four of them, would do on real issues rather than talking about tweets and insults and all kinds of complete nonsense that we have had to focus on during the course of the last year. It just would be a breath of fresh air for somebody to be talking about how do we manage the appropriate responsibilities of government without putting too much of a burden on the American people. And if we can find that out this evening, I think we would all regard that as a blessing.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Professor Marjorie Hershey.
You're most welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Professor Marjorie Hershey, who teaches political science at Indiana University. Her research focuses on political parties, campaigns, and elections, and she's the author of Party Politics in America, the major political party text now in its 17th edition, for which she received the American Political Science Association's Epstein Book Award for the best book on political parties. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.